This is Molly Smith introducing our annual Bringing America Back to Life speaker series. At this annual event, we invite those on the front lines of the pro-life and family movement to come together for a convention dedicated to exploring the full spectrum of issues and challenges that confront us as we continue to fight for the sanctity of human life, to protect our God-given family structure. We trust you will be edified and encouraged as you listen to our fine roster of speakers who by their articulate, thoughtful, expert presentations eloquently defend the right to life. It is now my distinct pleasure to introduce Marilyn Crisafi. Marilyn graduated from the University of Virginia in 1987 with a BSN. In 1992, she graduated from Cleveland Marshall Law School. Marilyn is the president and founder of Advocati, which is an organization dedicated to family, life, and religious freedom. She discusses the question, what do you need to know about life?
Okay, like Mr. Waters says, my name is Marilyn Crisafi. I'm a stay-at-home mom, so I decided to do a presentation on pornography. No, I'm kidding. The reason we're doing this presentation today is that there's a problem with both of these topics. There's a problem with pornography, and if you live in Ohio, you know that we've had more overdoses in this state than almost any other. There's been heroin and pornography in the headlines. I knew my children were going to be here today, and I did not feel comfortable writing out the word pornography, so you'll see a P in parentheses or brackets. That means pornography. Why are we talking about it? It's destroying the family, and it's bad for the workplace. We're losing lawyers' time to pornography, and we're losing lawyers to drug overdoses. What is an addiction? Well, we're going to talk about several aspects of it. Not only is it behavioral changes and physical changes, most of all, it's a neurochemical change in the brain. Some of the headlines you've seen about cocaine deaths and heroin deaths in Ohio are here. If you are a lawyer and you registered for this event, they're in your materials. You can log on here. I heard as recently as 2 days ago, a two-year-old child somehow got into mom or dad's drugs and overdosed, calling 911 when the baby turned blue. We were featured on 2020 last year, Heroin in the Heartland. It was nice to be on 2020. It was unfortunate that it was because we have so many drug overdoses. What about pornography? Did you guys know pornography is a multi-billion dollar industry? Did you know that some hotels allow pornography and some don't? You might want to check with your hotel before you check in whether or not they allow pornography to stream into the room. You can check out some of these websites, but not only is it damaging brains and on the rise, it's also contributing to divorce, which is another destruction to the family. Let's look at the effects that any kind of addiction is having on productivity. Drugs, alcohol, pornography, anything. An article by the Employment Screening Resource website showed that we're spending a lot of money helping our addicted employees, whether they want help or not. When they don't get help, it's costing us a lot of money. 38 to 50% of a worker's comp claims are made by people with substance abuse issues, and people with substance abuse issues are 3 to 5 times more likely to file claims. People with a substance abuse problem file medical costs up to 300% higher than most of their peers or peers working with them in the workplace. They're 2.5 times more likely to be absent 8 or more days a year, and they're not good for productivity. There's lost productivity, and they get fired or they quit. There's a lot of employee turnover. Other effects we're finding in the workplace, it's not good for the vibe in the office. People feel bad when they're around people that aren't doing their job. People feel bad when the person next to them doesn't feel well because they come in hungover or not feeling well. People feel bad when the guy next to them is looking at things on his screen that are not part of his job. It causes strained work relationships. People start to gossip about the addict at the water cooler. They're not getting help. They're getting talked about. Certain behaviors may also signal that there's a problem of abuse. Does your employee fall asleep after lunch? Do they avoid you or use a lot of breath mints? Do you find that they have bloodshot eyes or they're not coming in contact with people and they're hiding? That might imply a substance use issue. We talked about these a little bit, but not only are attitudes negatively affected, if your job is not in front of a computer or something involving a screen and you're a drug addict, you could be putting your coworkers in danger. The hypothetical I think about is on the shipping docks. You hand your employee something or you're driving heavy machinery, you could kill your coworkers. Well, what's an addiction? Why are when we talk about addiction, what is an addiction? Webster's Dictionary defines it three ways. An addiction is a compulsive need for a habit-forming substance. Its use, using the substance results in well-defined physiological symptoms when the person withdraws from use. And there's a compulsive, the compulsive use of the substance is known by the user to be harmful. Narcotics Anonymous also defines the addict. What's an addict? Well, we know who the addict is. Most of us don't have to think twice about what an addict is. We know. Our whole life and thinking is centered on drugs in one form or another. We spend our whole lives getting, using, and finding ways and means to get more drugs. Very simply, an addict is a man or woman whose life is controlled by drugs. We are people in the grip of a continuing and progressive illness whose ends are always the same: jail, institutions, or death. Well, what are some of the effects of addiction? We're going to talk about these: the neurological, neurochemical changes to the body, behavioral changes in actions and responses to activity with both heroin and pornography use, and physical changes to the body. There's physical changes to your brain in both in uses of both pornography and heroin, and emotional changes. So let's have a little brain biology first. We have drugs in our brain called neurotransmitters. They attach to certain things called receptors. It's a lock and key relationship. Certain neurotransmitters attach to certain receptors, and the ones that are regulated by a neurotransmitter called dopamine, those are the ones that regulate movement, emotion, motivation, and feelings of pleasure. Well, how do drugs work in the brain? The neurochemical is released, and the dopamine floods the brain's reward center, making the person want to repeat the behavior. At normal levels, this is good. God made us to want to eat, we stay healthy, we repopulate. That produces another surge of dopamine. That's good. God wants us to populate earth and heaven. So these are all natural and good. But when they're activated at abnormal levels with abnormal behaviors or drug use, it overstimulates the system. You guys have heard of tolerance. That's when the body is introduced to the neurochemical and at such a rate that you require more and more of it to get the same effect. So how does the drug heroin work in the scheme of things? Heroin mimics, unfortunately, one of the neurotransmitters. And so it locks onto the receptor, and it causes a reaction, but not exactly the same. It sends an abnormal message through the network. Like we just talked about with the use and abuse, the brain will adjust to the surges in the dopamine. The brain produces less dopamine or doesn't create as many receptors, and the user's ability to experience pleasure is reduced. Now, when this happens, they find they need more of the drug to just feel the normal baseline that you and I feel. And after a while, when they use even more, they need, and the body stops making the dopamine and expects you to supply the drug. When the drug diminishes and the body's normal supply diminishes, the person actually has to start taking the drug in order to feel not bad. So whereas they started out taking it to feel good, now they have to take it to feel not bad. What's the mechanism of action of opiates like heroin? Well, they're used to treat pain. And one of the mechanisms of action is to slow breathing, to block the pain, and it also gives a general calming and antidepressant effect. As you know, most heroin addicts go out in fourth grade and say, "I want to be a heroin addict and ruin my life." No, that's not what happens. No one goes to work or to school in the morning deciding that they want to ruin their lives or overdose on heroin. Most of it starts when one of us has a simple procedure like a wisdom tooth extraction, an ACL repair, something like that, where the doctor prescribes one of these high-potency drugs like Vicodin, OxyContin, or Percocet. 80% of this starts when someone had a prescription drug, they ran out of the prescription, and they wanted or needed more. This isn't on the PowerPoint, but what I think happens and what I've heard happens, they go to the street, they try to buy the drug. The drug costs XX dollars. The person supplying the drug on the street says, hey, I can get you that for $500, but try this, it's $1.50. And the drug they're buying cheaper is heroin. And the reason it's cheaper is that it's not a regulated drug and nobody really knows what's in it because it's not made in a laboratory of a drug company. It's usually made in someone's home. Since there is a flood of pharmaceuticals available, it's made it easier for doctors to prescribe some of these drugs. The other reason we're seeing a lot of these drugs prescribed is the pain scale. When I graduated from nursing school some years ago, there was no such thing as the pain scale. If you came in with a trauma or if you had surgery, it was understood you were going to hurt. When you get in a car accident, you have pain. It was kind of understood. The nurses treated you for pain. You got medication so that you were comfortable, but it wasn't the first thing we talked about on admission. It wasn't the first question the nurse asked you when she walked in the room. Are you having pain? You're not having pain, are you? We don't want you to have pain, ever. And you had the smiley face or the frowny face or the big frowny face because that was the worst. You didn't want to have the big frowny face. So we gave you Vicodin or OxyContin or Percocet. And because of this, that has kind of fed into the overprescription of prescription medication. Heroin's really deadly because no one really knows the potency of each different drug. We don't know what is in each dose. The other thing is, not only is its mechanism of action to suppress the breathing, and if you take too much, your breath will be suppressed to the effect where it stops. It's also historically taken with other drugs. It's not often that a heroin addict will go to a tea party and have heroin. Often they're at a party where alcohol is served or at a party where other drugs are being used. And it has an effect of potentiating the effect of the drug. That is to say, this drug has an effect like this. This drug has an effect like this. You mix them together and it has a double or triple effect. So what about pornography? Who wants to talk about that? I mean, that's a personal problem. Jimmy does behind closed doors is none of anybody's business. It's fine, really. It's none of our business. Okay, that's not actually the truth because speaking from my own personal background and faith tradition, there's no such thing as a personal sin. It affects everybody. And in the case of pornography, we're starting to see that it's affecting the culture. It's affecting families. It's affecting everybody. It is directly linked to marital problems. It tests the family values within the marriage. And what starts to happen is the person who's used to looking at pornography on a fake screen somewhere, they no longer have the feelings of love that God put together with the act. So where we have John Paul II talked a lot about the self-giving, self-sacrificing love in the marriage, we don't have that with pornography. We have a picture. None of the self-giving love that's talked about in many of his treatises. I talked about the dysfunction in the family, but it's also degrading to women. Most of the pornography is still involving women as the subject. It exploits children. We have heard cases over and over and over again. Sadly, when I worked with Judge Dowd, there were cases on his desk involving child pornography. It's epidemic, and it's awful. It's terrible, and we need to talk about it so that people can avoid it and teach their families. And we also see that there's a direct link to human trafficking and prostitution. Fortunately, there's an organization around town, I can't remember the name, but some organization to stop human trafficking. They're on it, and they're trying to do things to prevent it and pick it up in some of the places where you see it, emergency rooms, hotels, stuff like that. People can intervene and at least notify authorities that someone's in trouble. I talked about the neurochemistry of the brain on drugs. Did you know there are neurochemical changes when there's, and the S stands for sex, so the girls aren't, they're on their phone. But normally, as I said, God wants us to do this. He gives us the feeling of pleasure naturally. There's dopamine that's released just as there's dopamine released when we eat. When we eat, we get a feeling of pleasure. We want to eat again. Same with human relations. The brain is wired to ensure that people repeat life-sustaining activities. That's the way we're made. So are there brain changes with pornography? Really? It's like, yeah, there are, and there have been studies. There's a doctor at the University of Texas that did a study on the frontal lobe of the brain when people were engaged in compulsive behaviors. So he studied, for example, a person who had eaten to a point of obesity, and that person had, you know, from doing that behavior over and over, frontal brain loss, frontal lobe loss in the brain. The MRI showed the changes in the white matter. Same in the patients who were unable to control the sexual activity. Their over-release of dopamine also caused frontal lobe loss. They were able to compare the brains of someone who had misused an exogenous or from the outside drug to a patient who had manipulated his body in a way that its own drug was overproduced, and the frontal lobe loss in the brain was exactly the same. The Texas doctor looked at a German study that confirmed this. When I first started researching this topic, I had just assumed that 90 or 100% of the pornography was going on like between 9P and 12A, you know, someone at night at home, you know, people. No, 75% of this is going on from 9 to 5, 70%. Between 9 to 5. Those are work hours. People are at work taking their employer's dollars for work and looking at pornography. 25% of adults admit to looking at it on their computers at work. Two-thirds of human resources people say that their employees have it on their computers. And 28% of people that work with a computer at work admitted that, yeah, I've downloaded a sexually explicit picture onto my work computer. The paper type of pornography, so going back 10, 20 years, how do people get hooked on that? I have heard stories. Some people just stumble upon it, but they aren't able to say, I don't think I should be looking at that. There is something innate in a person that will say, yeah, I probably shouldn't be seeing that, but some people are intrigued to keep going back to sources and looking at it over and over. There are emotional character conflicts that are recognized that lead people to engage in the behavior more and more. If you go to maritalhealing.com, they do recognize these top three: selfishness, loneliness and sadness, and marital conflicts. So I haven't polled my husband, but he'd probably pick three. I can't help it. I'm married to an angry, controlling, critical, selfish spouse. No, I'm kidding. It's not funny. But there are definite characteristics and traits that make a person resort to pornography use, misuse, and abuse. In any addiction, there are going to be behavioral effects. The Ohio Lawyers Assistance Program has noted these, and I've talked about these in some of my other slides. Inappropriate behaviors and moods, the pleadings that you put out if you're a lawyer, they aren't good pleadings or they're inaccurate or not asserting what you mean to assert. Your performance is not good. People are gossiping about you out in the halls and around the water cooler. There may be malpractice or disciplinary claims. And after a while, you just miss your court appointments. You don't get to that deposition. You forget about the hearing. You miss the depots. And then after a while, no one respects your work. You lose clients, and your firm suffers in its reputation. Other behavioral effects, we're going to take a quiz. Let's talk about the behavior of an addict, alcohol, pornography, anything. This is taken right from the AA website. It's kind of a quiz. Do you guys know anybody, or have you ever decided to stop drinking or using heroin or pornography for a week or so, but it only lasted a couple of days? Do you wish people would mind their own business about your use, stop telling you what to do? Have you ever switched from one kind of substance to another, hoping maybe that would help? Do you envy people who can use whatever it is without getting into trouble? Have you had problems connecting, or have you had problems connected with the use of whatever it is over the past year? Is it causing problems at home? Do you tell yourself, I can put that stuff down anytime I want. I don't need to look at that. I don't need to drink that. I don't need to shoot that stuff up. But you keep using it anyway. Have you missed days of work or school? Or have you ever felt that your life would be better if you just didn't use whatever it is? Let's look at some of the physical effects of heroin, and then we'll talk about the emotional effects. Well, first of all, as you recall from the person that described what an addict is, they mentioned that they spend their entire day using, figuring out when they can use next, or trying to find the resources to get more drugs to use. When you're consumed with those things, you do not have time to do things like shower, wash your hair, change your clothes, go to the dry cleaner. So your personal hygiene starts to plummet. With the heroin addict specifically, because the drug is injected, there's bad effects on the vasculature, collapsed veins, infections of the heart valves and the vasculature, abscesses at the place of injection. Also, there's opioid-related constipation. I've heard ads for this on the television. I'm sure the target audience is not heroin addicts, but there are so many problems with drugs that are prescribed that cause constipation. There's ads on TV for drugs to reverse that now. It can also cause liver, kidney disease, lung complications, pneumonia, organ damage, hormonal imbalances, fertility issues. If you're a woman that's trying to get pregnant or are carrying a child, God forbid, heroin will directly affect that. HIV/AIDS from the needle use. And there's also neurological and emotional effects of this drug use. And if you have an emotional problem or a mental issue already, it's going to make it worse. That includes depression, anxiety, aggression, mood swings, paranoia, psychosis. What about the emotional effects of pornography? Again, isn't this just something people should just leave in their, you know, it's, he's got it under control, you know, Friday nights, it's no big deal. It doesn't affect the person. Well, one person has come forward, at least on this website, to talk about what it's like in recovery from pornography. This disorder has made it extremely difficult to see the beauty in others, okay? It is a selfish disease that has made it impossible to see beauty in others and merely appreciate life. I have low confidence, and it's harder to serve and give myself to others. My social life has been affected, although I push myself to do what I must to endure and succeed. I have no desire to date, and social anxiety permeates my interactions with others. It's sad. So how do you get help? Well, if you don't have a problem, you don't need help. So if you know someone that has a problem, but they don't have a problem, they can't get help. For any problem in a 12-step area, if the person doesn't take that first step and admit they have a problem, there's no way they can get help, because no one goes seeking help for a problem they don't have. Once again, a great tool for Ohio lawyers. I know not all of you are from Ohio. You might want to look into your state to see if they have something similar. The Ohio Lawyers Assistance Program. It's confidential. They're not going to call any agency and talk about it. It's a safe place you can go to ask questions and see if you can get help and if you need help. Other addiction sites, AA, the first, 12-step program ever, right here in the United States, here in Ohio. Get on their website, and they have links to other websites. And NA, which is Narcotics Anonymous. And there's the link to OLAP. Almost every county in Ohio has some sort of drug alcohol board. In Cuyahoga County, it's a drug addiction board of Cuyahoga County. Summit County, any of you guys from the east, southeast side? Summit County Drug Addiction Board. Drug Addiction Services of Lorain County. And for your kids and spouses, let's say you don't have a problem, and your friend doesn't have a problem either, because there's no problem. Everybody's fine, okay? But you see the kids are suffering. No one's taking them to practice. They're not getting fed. No one's washed their uniform in a week. There's a lot of stuff going on the spouse is covering up for. Maybe you could at least suggest somehow that the spouse can get help for the problem that their spouse doesn't have, and that would be Al-Anon Alateen. It's a 12-step program for people who are living with the problem of a loved one who has some sort of addiction or disorder. There is help specifically for someone who's addicted to pornography. Just like AA and NA, there's now SA, Sexaholics Anonymous. There is an SAA, which is Sex Addicts Anonymous. That is for persons who are just trying to not to engage in sexual compulsive behavior. Sexaholics Anonymous goes a step further to say that their goal is to have sex in a marriage between a man and a woman. So they do distinguish between those two. And there was some sort of split early on about whether they talk about sex between a man and a woman in a marriage or not. So they split over that. SA is the one that believes in sexual relations between a man and a woman in a marriage. Integrity Restored is another good website. And in a marriage, the spouses can get help at maritalhealing.com. Books, which I mentioned on the next page, many books out there, Delivered and Restored. Restored is written from the perspective of husband and wife, where Delivered is just the story of Matt Fradd, who has recovered from pornography addiction. Faith-based ministries, books, and webinars also available. Did you hear one of the other speakers talking about euthanasia? I think it was Mr. Terrio. Euthanasia is now being suggested as a treatment in the Netherlands. So if you're in the Netherlands and you discover, you know what, I'm a hopeless addict, there's no chance I'm ever going to break free, they will euthanize you because there's now euthanasia available for alcoholics. That's in your materials. So if you need the website, you're going to call it a day, you don't feel like trying anymore, go on ahead, go to the Netherlands, and they will euthanize you. So Mother Teresa used to say, be the one. She would think of Jesus and how he would say, I looked for comfort and there wasn't anyone. So she would encourage her missionaries of charity to be the one. Each one of us can be the one. We can be the one to have the courage to go up to someone and say, hey, I notice you've been struggling. Can I give you a website? Hey, I notice your behavior's a little funky. Can I talk to you? I think I can find you some help. Be the one that goes out there and comforts the body of Christ, which is his people. He prayed and prayed, and then he went to look for consolation, but there was none. I always write that sentence. I looked for one to comfort me, but I found no one. Then I write, be the one. So now you be that one. Try to be the one to share with him, to comfort him, and to console him by consoling the people, which are his body. Any questions?
I was just curious, is there something you highlighted the legal profession as susceptible to these addictions as opposed to any other? What is it about the legal profession? Obviously, there's pressure in any attempt profession. Just curious.
Sure. Oh, the reason I highlight the legal profession is so that the lawyers here can get continuing education hours for the Ohio Supreme Court. So, and that's a good disclaimer to make. This presentation in no way suggests or tells that lawyers have a bigger problem than anyone else in any one of these. But that's a very good question. No, any high-stress professional or any, you know, the addict is the Skid Row guy you see under the bridge by St. Malachi, and the addict is the neurosurgeon you see who's making the big bucks under a lot of stress.
But it's interesting that they have a specific support group.
Right. Indeed they do, the Ohio Lawyers Assistance Program. And I think there might be one for physicians and other professionals. Yeah, indeed. Mr. Meissner?
Yes, Carolyn, you gave some interesting statistics toward the beginning of your presentation. My understanding is that over half of the internet traffic is pornography.
Half? Wow.
That's since the beginning. I read that a couple places. I don't know if it, you know, others have seen that or not. The other is that the whole emphasis in terms of pornography spreads to all the other media.
Right.
I mean, if you compare what's on television now for a so-called sitcom
right.
with what was there 20 or 30 years ago,
right.
you can see, you know, an immense change
right.
in what's being presented as ordinary media. So,
right. And Joe, if I could comment on that, that's an excellent point. There is a word that is used to harden people to things that should be private. And I can't remember what that word is. It's not grooming, but it's something like that. And when we start to think that things that are not right and not normal are normal, they push it further and further. You know, if you ever watched I Love Lucy in black and white, I don't know how many years ago, they were in separate beds. And there is no way they would ever show anybody in bed together. There was no question that Lucy and Ricky were married. But the television would never show something like that. And now we have programs. I specifically recall, I think 8-10 years ago, I walked into a health club and on TV was a soap opera with two men in bed kissing with wine. And I'm like, it's like I blinked and something horrible happened. And that was 8 years ago. So yeah, the more internet traffic our kids are getting and our adults are getting, the more we're seeing it in the prime time on TV. You were going to make another point, I believe.
Yes, you know, you talked about how it can split up marriages. I'm sorry, but I know couples where one drags the other into it. Before you know it, two are addicted.
Right. I'm sure that happens, and I suspect that eventually a jealousy, a God-made jealousy of one spouse for the other's look upon another person would interfere with and destroy that marriage eventually. I don't know, but that's my suspicion, sir.
Since there are physiological changes and our culture is saturated with this, I assume most frontal lobes are being affected.
Wouldn't you love to see it? If you could get your insurance company to cover an MRI, though, you know, we'd be happy to see that.
Is there recovery on a physical level, frontal lobe, et cetera, or basically is half the culture?
I don't think that there's regeneration of the brain, but I do know that with some of the help suggested and some of the therapies and 12-step programs, they teach you how to live your life free from that behavior of the substance.
They can't reverse any of the physical damage.
No. I mean, the physical changes I talked about, pneumonia and that type of thing, and you know that, but the brain doesn't regenerate, I don't think. Mr. Sheets?
Yes, thank you, ma'am. I recently sat through a presentation by the director of just the governor's opioid prevention task.
Great.
And she made the claim, I'm assuming backed by science, that as far as chronic pain management, that a combination, I believe she said it was 500 milligram acetaminophen and 500 milligram ibuprofen taken together, has more of impact on chronic pain than any opioid. Now, and I know that you have a medical background, so I saw that because it was a significant and measurable.
Right, right.
You can get more pain control out of those two over-the-counter types.
Those are very reasonable and potent and effective drugs, and they're underused. And perhaps this is the cynic in me, but I wonder if the medications that are coming from the pharmaceutical companies that make quite a bit of money on those drugs, maybe the popularity of prescribing those comes from the fact that there are quite a few drug reps on the market that are going around really encouraging the docs to prescribe their product. So, yeah, I think that's accurate. I bet that the, you know, Tylenol and Motrin are very effective. So, yes, Mr. Lynch.
Marilyn, are you aware that there's some medical professionals that actually recommend pornography to help some, and is that accepted generally by
I have never heard that, but I don't doubt it. I'm sure that's true. And there are websites I came across that dispute that pornography is even an addiction. And they dispute that there's anything wrong with it and that, you know, there's recommendations on how to use it. And to me that, you know, for obvious reasons, that they're linking directly divorce, marital troubles, exploitation of children, sex trafficking and prostitution to the use of pornography, I can't see how any medical professional in his good conscience could recommend its use. Mrs. Crespo?
In the presentation, Mr.
Terrio?
He was pointing out...
Take heart. When I first met him, I called him Mr. Theriot. You were very kind.
How that many professionals who want to pursue medicine or psychiatry or whatever, they are weeding out during the course of their studies. So we as consumers have to be very careful. If we want to look for a professional that has solid moral foundation to their practice, we as consumers have very slim pickings.
Right.
So many people who have moral convictions
have been weeded out of the
education program.
Right.
We do need to be active consumers, and then we'll wrap up so our panel can start. But we need to be active participants in finding our healthcare professionals. And this is all Obamacare aside, and we pray that good changes are coming, and we see efforts already. But when we go to the doctor, we need to ask questions about, you know, well, what do you do? Do you do abortions? Do you prescribe contraception? What do you do here? Do you believe in prescribing medications? And also, when you get your wisdom teeth pulled and you get a 90-day supply of Percocet, it's okay to say no. It's like, oh, thanks, doctor. I'll take Tylenol. No reason that we have to accept a prescription. That's being a good consumer, too. I thank you very much for your time, and I now invite our panel up. Thank you.
All right, next we'll hear a panel discussion led by Brian Hurley, Mr. McCraig, and Mr. Terrio, moderated by Maren Crisafi. Brian Hurley has not been introduced. He's a Cleveland native who currently serves as of counsel for Cincinnati, Ohio law firm of Schroeder, Mondrell, Barbary, and Powers. He maintains both a litigation and consultant expert witness practice at the current time. He's represented clients in litigation against Planned Parenthood involving informed consent statutes. He's an advisor to Pregnancy Center West in Cincinnati and the Cincinnati Right to Life. He's received the Life Legal Defense Foundation's National Lawyer of the Year Award, Cincinnati Right to Life's Hero for Life Award, and the Alliance Defending Freedom Silver Service Award for over 5,000 pro bono hours. He's received the Cardinal Robert J. Bellamarine S.J. Award from St. Ignatius High School. I'm a St. Ed's grad, so no. he's here. Thank you for coming, and thank you for participating.
When I was first asked to do this, I said I didn't think I could because I also coach high school basketball in mock trial, and it's in the heart of those seasons, and I just didn't think that I was going to have the time to make a presentation. And then Marilyn and I talked a little bit, and I said, well, maybe we could do a panel discussion, and these two fine gentlemen agreed to help me out. But before we get started, I'm going to resort to my coaching and also to my professor days. I'd like people to move up. This is going to be a much more informal session than the other sessions, and quite frankly, I think it'll be more effective because we want to have more participation of the individuals and who are here. The first part, I'll make a little presentation about our topic, but I really would encourage people who have any questions, any thoughts, really any advice to give it to us. As an initial matter, I really would like to thank a number of people and organizations. I was able to litigate the cases I did litigate, and I litigated against Planned Parenthood for about 13 years, if you combine the two cases together. So, despite the fact that my practice was pretty extensive and pretty broad-ranging, I had no idea what I was getting into. I really had no idea. And if it weren't for certain organizations, the ADF, for example, Life Legal Defense, Cincinnati Right to Life, Cleveland Right to Life, and to the chagrin of many of my more wealthy friends, many of them contributed because we had really no idea how expensive and what a battle we were getting into. One of the reasons I like to do this, and I wish we maybe had some younger lawyers here, is because there are many ways to fight this battle, many, many ways. But in the courts, the courts, is one of the ways, because Planned Parenthood has made such great strides and has had such great success because of what they've been able to do in the court system. And that is in part the general topic that we're going to talk about today, and that is what's been called the abortion distortion. I'm not as high-tech as a lot of other people. I usually have my staff come and do all this stuff for me, and they couldn't make it. When I talk about the abortion distortion, we're talking about how courts handle cases involving issues related to abortion or close to abortion. And those include the funding of Planned Parenthood. You're seeing not only debated in Congress, but also in the court systems throughout the United States in Ohio. The exercise of First Amendment rights for protesters. The exercise of First Amendment rights in the work setting, as was talked about by Kevin earlier. Born alive protection statutes. The morning after pill. In two areas that were really, really important in my lawsuits, when I say my lawsuits, I really need to say my clients' lawsuits, because these are two incredible, and I mean incredible, young women who had been raped and had really very little support and were willing to take on Planned Parenthood. Incredible people. And when I think about, and I mentioned this last night, heroes in my life, these two young women clearly are heroes in my life. One of them was raped by her father, treated her from age 14 through 17, basically as his wife. And despite the fact that she, when she had her abortion, told Planned Parenthood, "This wasn't supposed to happen. I was forced to do things I didn't want to do," which for those of you who know or in certain fields know that that's a trigger to report that abuse. It didn't get reported. And she continued to be raped by her father for a year and a half. And as an aside, to show you how distorted this can be, in part, one of the defenses that Planned Parenthood raised was, well, even if we should have done it, the harm was already done. And it didn't really matter that she was going to be raped again for another year and a half. As a litigator, I drooled at the fact of the possibility in getting in front of a jury on that. As I'll talk a little bit later, is we never got to court because we had some significant victories and significant losses in these cases that really helped in terms of legislation and also in terms of exposing Planned Parenthood for what they do and don't do. Former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor probably said it best, and I'm going to quote her in terms of what the abortion distortion is. In one of the decisions, and I think it was in 1992, she wrote, "This court's abortion decisions have already worked a major distortion in the court's constitutional jurisprudence. Today's decision goes further, and it makes it painfully clear that no legal rule or doctrine is safe from ad hoc nullification by this court when an occasion for its application arises in a case involving state regulation of abortion. The permissible scope of abortion regulation is not the only constitutional issue on which this court is divided, but except when it comes to abortion, the court has generally refused to let such disagreements, however longstanding or deeply felt, prevent it from even-handedly applying uncontroversial legal doctrines to cases that come before it." In layman's terms, what that really means is when Planned Parenthood and the abortion industry gets into court, they make arguments that, in my opinion, and I found out the hard way my opinion was wrong, that would never be raised in any other legal setting, whether it be Section 1983 civil rights cases, whether there'd be in employment cases. They would never make these arguments because, in my opinion, they were laughable. And I would look at the Planned Parenthood lawyers And when I talk about Planned Parenthood lawyers, there's usually teams of them, not only from the area where you are, but also from New York City, depending on the importance of the issues in your case. And they would make these arguments, and I would look over and think, can you make that argument with a straight face? Well, the answer was not only yes, but many times I lost. I would walk out of the courtroom and listen to the court's decision and think, how could that possibly happen? That happened to me at the Supreme Court of Ohio, and we can talk about that a little bit later. How has this abortion distortion hurt us? Well, I'm going to quote Mother Teresa, and if you have looked at my bio, one of the things that I do with my sister, who was a lay missionary in Haiti, we work with Mother Teresa's organization to build homes, to help an orphanage. And so I don't think there's a greater source or a better source to look at as to what we're really facing as a result of this abortion distortion. And she wrote this in a brief that was filed at the United States Supreme Court. Her lawyer was a professor out of Princeton, Professor George, who is a brilliant constitutional lawyer. And here's Mother Teresa's words. America needs no words from me to see how your decision in Roe versus Wade has deformed a great nation. The so-called right to abortion has pitted mothers against their children and women against men. It has sown violence and discord at the heart of the most intimate of human relationships. It has aggravated the derogation of the father's role in an increasingly fatherless society. It has portrayed the greatest gifts, children, as a competitor or as competitors, an intrusion and an inconvenience. It has nominally accorded mothers unfettered domination over the independent lives of their physically dependent sons and daughters. And in granting this unconscionable power, it has exposed many women to unjust and selfish demands from their husbands and other sexual partners. One of the things that I learned in these pieces of litigation was how much support lawyers need in taking on somebody like Planned Parenthood. And I don't mean that in just financial, but I do mean it financial. I will give you an estimate. We estimated that Planned Parenthood spent somewhere around $5 to $7 million to defend against our cases. $5 to $7 million. The other thing I would say is prayer and support of your parishes, Right to Life groups, pregnancy centers. I can't tell you how many times in the midst of this litigation, and there were some really good times, and there was other times, and for those of you who are lawyers will get this, when at 5 o'clock on Friday, you start getting emails coming in, and they're like 5, 10, 15 motions that you have to respond to, and you thought you were going to have a weekend. Well, you were, but it was going to be responding to much of the nonsense. And the other thing, and Josh and I talked about this earlier, for any lawyers who want to take on an organization like Planned Parenthood, it's also so important to get the support, at least in part, of members of your firm. The division that it can create is real, and the resources it takes to defend can really cause fractures in your practice. That being said, I couldn't encourage people more, lawyers more, to do this. While I was going through it, I'm not sure how I felt about it because I was doing so many other things. I had my own practice, actually trying to make money. But I will say that in terms of my professional career, they were the most important things I ever did. And I met such incredible, incredible people. I look back, would I do it again? Without a doubt. Would I do it a little differently sometimes? Absolutely. So that's the formal part of this presentation. What I would really encourage is, and I think Marilyn's going to ask some of us questions. If any of you have any questions about any of those topics, feel free. I want this to be an open discussion. I want this to be as informal as possible. So thank you.
First of all, I will talk about, I'll ask before I'll talk. First of all, Mr. Terrio, any experience at all you've had directly with Planned Parenthood?
Yeah, right now we are. Can y'all hear me okay? Yeah, okay.
I'm usually loud, but at any rate, right now we're litigating a case against Planned Parenthood in Iowa. Our client, Sue Thayer, is a former Planned Parenthood director. And she basically, it's a long story, but essentially when they started making her do chemical abortions, she got out. And she's been an incredible source of information about what they do and how they do it. And, Planned Parenthood gets $500 million a year from the federal government, and that's only half of their funding. So, a billion-dollar a year organization, they got plenty of money, and they really defend themselves very stoutly. Now, at the same time, they, as you might guess, are not exactly ethically bound by many of the ethics concerns that we have. Let me say it that way. And one of the concerns that Sue, our client, had was that they would, for instance, when prescribing oral contraception for women, they would buy it for $2, prescribe it without a doctor being involved, and actually ask the women to donate and then bill the government, Medicaid for for $6, and just a scam going on. And they would put these women on a mail order situation. So you sign up for it. It's kind of like signing up for the National Geographic. It's hard to unsign up for it. You know, you sign up for it and they keep sending it to you, whether you're of childbearing age or not. And anyway, so we've sued them in what's called a QI-TAM case. You may be familiar with that. It's essentially a whistleblower case. And they have hired one of the biggest firms in the world, Dentons, to represent them. It's an international firm. I was just looking it up. They have offices in every country you can imagine. I couldn't even count them up. There were that many. They're just all over the place. And so huge firm, as big a team as you can get. But let me just say, we at Alliance Defending Freedom, we have 50 lawyers. We have, three of us assigned to this case, and when we have one of our local allies, people like Josh and like Brian, who are allied with ADF, we fund some of their work, and they're professional people that oftentimes work for big firms. This guy happens to be, his name is Russ Hickson, a MedMal guy in Des Moines. It's just fantastic, and so we're actually keeping pace and standing toe to toe with the big firms that big firm that Planned Parenthood has hired, and we're doing well. We lost at the trial court level, got dismissed, went up to the Eighth Circuit, got it reversed, back down to the trial court. Of course, Planned Parenthood filed another motion to dismiss, filed that motion to dismiss. Now we're in discovery, and of course, they don't want to give us any records. So now we're slugging it out with them. But, they will fight and scratch and claw for every little thing and make it tough. But even with two nonprofit attorneys and one attorney who's, if we win, he'll get his attorney's fees paid. But we really don't have a high-priced legal team at all, and we're able to contend with them, and we've had some success. So,
Mr. McCaig, any any experience with Planned Parenthood, or should I go to my next question? My question is for Brian, actually. Brian, if you recall, many years ago, there was a amicus brief filed on behalf of one of your clients by Cleveland Lawyers for Life. And unfortunately, it was a medical records release, privileged records, privileged documents, even with the names redacted, Social Security numbers redacted. Planned Parenthood still refused to release those records, which I believe would have shown a pattern of allowing underage girls to have abortions without consent and other things, abuse too. Can you tell me what finally happened when I left off following that case? The court had struck down the motion, saying that no, it was still too great a risk. These girls seeking abortions needed their privacy, despite the fact that some of them were being abused at home. And there were many malpractice defense firms using that case to keep their own hospitals and doctor's offices from having to turn over records. Just tell me a little bit about what happened with that records release issue and where it stands now.
Sure. Let me give you a little context. In both of our cases, what we alleged was that our clients had made statements or had done things that put Planned Parenthood on notice that they were being abused. And the law in Ohio requires not only abortion providers, many other professionals, if they suspect or know that abuse is taking place, they have to report it. Well, so we had that, and then in addition to the fact that we had the facts in our case, we had seen the Lila Rose videos, and I'm not sure if you know who Lila Rose is, but Lila Rose was a young co-ed at UCLA who posed as a 14-year-old girl who went around to a bunch of Planned Parenthood clinics and told the people she was meeting with she was 14 years old and she had a partner. She was pregnant and she had a partner who was, I think, 23 or 24. And this wasn't a one-off deal. This is where every single clinic she went to. And at those clinics, what she was advised was, don't tell us that. Do not give us that information. Because if you give us that information, we have to report it. So let's go back to square one. And that's what, so we knew what was happening. There's an organization out of Texas that had done a similar research. So for those of you who aren't lawyers to understand where we are at, in litigation, you make allegations, you make claims, and then the normal process is that you obtain, and oftentimes it's through the other party, the information you need to win your case, to prove your claims. That's called discovery. So what did we do? We asked for, and ironically, obtained initially, Planned Parenthood of Southwest Ohio's abuse reporting records for 10 years. Of course, redacted, because we did not want and never wanted the names of the individuals who were the subjects of those reports. All we wanted to do was get records to help us establish our claim that this was a pattern in practice. This was a policy of Planned Parenthood to not report abuse. This is a big deal. I mean, what ends up happening is what Planned Parenthood does is ignores many of these, and these young women, you know, mostly girls, are then sent out and subjected to abuse again. So, and this is a perfect question for the abortion distortion. I ask for all those records. I get them. The Planned Parenthood appeals, and I think we're going to win because I know the panel. I know everybody on the panel. And this goes to really the question oftentimes of when judges are appointed who you think are pro-life, oftentimes don't turn out to be that way. I lose. So we go to the Supreme Court of Ohio. And again, I'm getting grilled by the Supreme Court saying, what evidence do you have that there's a pattern in practice? Now, again, put this in the context of where we're supposed to be. This is discovery. You know, my allegations were, this is a pattern of practice. I get to discover that information. I get to find that information so I can prove my claims. Well, if you litigate against Planned Parenthood, you get your head kicked in a lot, and you just got to keep on keeping on. We lost that, but this goes to then what a good thing that came out of it. I started working with members of the Ohio legislature who work with the Ohio legislature saying, hey, listen, I lost this. We need to change the law. And the Ohio reporting statute was changed, modified, amended, to include the right of plaintiffs' lawyers in these cases to get that information, redacted, of course, to show patterns in practice. Oh, I'm sorry. Reporting is if you find out that or suspect there's abuse, you need to go to the prosecutor or to the police to inform law enforcement that you suspect or know of abuse. So then the prosecutor or whoever you go to, the police, can make an investigation. That's a whole other issue about whether that ever happens.
What if the 14-year-old didn't think it was abusive?
It doesn't matter. Because most of the time, they don't. Most of the time, they think they're in love.
But explain the age.
Well, and I'd have to look at the statute again, the criminal statute. If a young girl is certain age, if she's under 18, then there's an age difference between her and her sexual partner that is big enough, then that is, as a matter of law, a crime.
It's statutory rape.
What happens is, and this is again, this is really another example of the abortion distortion. The papers that were filed by abortion supporting groups pretty much said, although they didn't come out completely and say this, that we should decide, the abortion provider should decide whether we report, because young girls won't come to us. They'll be afraid to come to us. So if they know that we're going to report this abuse to the police or to the prosecutor, we won't have young girls coming to us. Now, all right, you can intellectually argue that, and my argument against Planned Parenthood on that was very simple. I don't agree with you, but go to the legislature. That's your remedy. You can't just decide to ignore the law because you think you know better. One other thing I will say about that at least helped us with respect to that decision, there's a big question we had as to whether there was a private right of action for the young girls to be able to bring a lawsuit. That's always been their policy. And in fact, in part, is why we ended up resolving the cases, because we got some really good decisions. I didn't lose everything in these cases. We won some things. And eventually what happened is, because of that issue and also the issue of whether or not under the informed consent statute they had an obligation to tell young women and girls that, in fact, they could suffer from emotional harm, PTSD, suicidal thoughts. Those are issues they did not want to litigate with us, and we were going to litigate, and we eventually resolved them. I guess the last thing I was going to say is that another good thing that resulted from it is part of the amendment, the Ohio legislature made very clear that women, young girls, and their families do have private rights of action to sue abortion providers for failure to report abuse. In addition to that, added a punitive damage provision, which was critical for plaintiff's lawyers.
Mr. Terrio, tell me in your experience, have you gone to pretrials or court hearings against Planned Parenthood?
Yes.
And what was their, did they bring one lawyer, or what was that?
No, the ones I've been involved in, it's one or two, and they're not trial. At trial, I haven't been in trial against Planned Parenthood, but there were two on a hearing that we had. It was a status conference over the phone just last week. There were two. It's interesting. They generally come in seeming very, trying to appear very reasonable, as all good lawyers do. And so, you know, we don't want to hand over these records. We've already handed over thousands of pages of records. Therefore, we don't have to hand over the ones they really need. You know, that's sort of their modus operandi. But, you know, they lawyer up, although I think they're always concerned about appearing to have too many lawyers. But, you know, with a firm with, hundreds of lawyers like Demont has, or Denton has, excuse me, then, you know, they've got as many at their disposal as they can get. So it's quite real. And just a quick story about Sue Thayer, our client, and Lila Rose. Lila Rose interviewed Sue. You can go. As a matter of fact, they just did some videos that feature Sue and another former abortion director. Anyway, Sue, I went with Sue to be interviewed with Lila over at in California. And she met Lila for the first time. And Lila is young. She looked young. If she could do 14 when she was in college, she's probably 26 or 7 now, still looks young. And Sue just was it was just a fantastic opportunity for Sue to meet her. And she says, "You realize that I've seen your picture in my Planned Parenthood for years." So Planned Parenthood figured out that she was going out and doing this undercover thing. And they distributed her picture like a wanted poster to all the Planned Parenthood clinics around the country and said, "If this girl shows up, do not talk to her because she is embarrassing the heck out of us." So anyway, interesting sidelight on that.
Wanted. My next question is for Mr. Hurley. Tell me what your experience is with the disclosures of risks. For example, does Planned Parenthood tell girls that they might have bleeding? Does Planned Parenthood tell girls that they might have problems later getting pregnant or that they might have depression? What has your experience been with that issue of informed consent?
The answer to that is yes in part and no in large part. Let me tell you what happened in the case I had with the 14-year-old girl, and that will lead into the answer to these. And this is really going to be the short version. It took me 8 hours of a deposition to get to this point. Planned Parenthood had an informed consent form that would be signed by a young girl or a woman contemplating having an abortion procedure. It's 2 pages long. So, you know, I have a number of degrees. I think I can read pretty well. I read it. I don't understand most of it. So what I did was I went through with the woman who obtained the signature from my client every single risk that was listed. Well, she knew about 5% of them. So we have the person who's supposed to be obtaining the informed consent, providing information to let the young girl or woman know what the risks are, who has no idea what she's talking about. Ultimately, though, what it came down to was this, and this is, again, after 7 or 8 hours. I said, "We know that she signed this document. I got the consent part. I'm still a little confused about the informed part." And what she said to me, this counselor, was, with a look of disdain, "Your client read it, and she signed it." I said, "Really?" I said, "Could my client read?" Dead silence. And I said, "Let me give you a little clue what's going to happen at trial. My client couldn't read. So she signed a document that she couldn't possibly have understood. Now, on a bigger scale, and I've been working with Barry on this and since I Right to Life, it's been a passion of mine, is that with respect to the risks that are involved, there's two that I've really focused on, and they were big parts of my case. One is the failure and the refusal of Planned Parenthood to discuss the link between abortions and increased risk of breast cancer. Now, I'm going to tell you, there's a dispute in the medical community about that. But my position is, okay, that's a dispute, but that doesn't give you, Planned Parenthood, the right to decide which information for the woman to decide. One of the speeches I give, and I've invited Planned Parenthood to debate me on this, is entitled, "Whose Choice Is It?" I said, let's not talk about Roe versus Wade. Let's talk about your word, choice. Isn't it the woman's choice? Shouldn't she be the one informed about what the risks are? But even worse than that is, and I have not seen Planned Parenthood's informed consent form in a few years, but in my cases, when they talked about the risk of psychological harm, this is what they said. You may feel guilty for a little while. And I'm paraphrasing, and this is what a lot of my friends who say when I do plaintiff's work do. They say it's going to go away. Well, I had a client who was depressed, suicidal, had PTSD. It wasn't going away. And what Planned Parenthood does then is they just lie about what is serious, a serious risk that these women are facing. So we are now attempting, right, Barry? We are attempting to amend the informed consent statute to include a specific requirement that of the risks they have to disclose and discuss are the link between abortion and breast cancer and the real risk of psychological and emotional harm. As an aside, this is how we end up winning one of our cases. If you litigate these cases, you realize it's hard to get experts, very hard, because you can find experts who are pro-life and those who are pro-choice, but many don't want to get involved for a lot of reasons and can't get involved for a number of reasons. So we took a risk, and we went out and hired a woman who is considered by, and she's in the VA, the top post-traumatic stress expert in the Midwest, pro-choice. And I said to her, I need you to tell me how this is. Tell me the truth. Forget all the agendas that people have. Evaluate my client. And lo and behold, she found she had post-traumatic stress, suicidal thoughts, depression, all connected directly to her abortion. The case was over at that point because it's such an important issue to Planned Parenthood. They couldn't afford to have a litigation, and at the time, probably none of you would know, but these cases had national implication. We were on national TV talking about these things. Planned Parenthood knew that they couldn't have a judgment against them where there was a finding on these issues. So what they did, and I knew this was a possibility when I went into the cases, my clients were dirt poor. One of my clients, father goes to prison, mother's a prostitute, she has nothing. What Planned Parenthood did was throw money at them, make us go away. And that was my obligation, it was to my client, not to a cause at that point, and we went away. So I went to Plan B, and that is to work with the Ohio legislature to change the Ohio law.
Thank you. We have all but run out of time. It's over 2 o'clock, and I need to relinquish the room. But I do want to say that thanks to your work and your willingness to persevere, you know, the devil has no problem finding money and finding resources. That's rampant upon this earth. But, you know, not that I took anything like a kick to the head, but a lawyer I used to work with laughed at me when that case was lost and said, "We're using your case all the time." And I never have forgotten it. And that was one teeny tiny little bit of work I did to help for, you know. So you have to definitely put your pride in a box, put it high up on a shelf, and not even worry about it, and know that you're going out there for the girl who is being taken advantage of by a multi-billion dollar organization. You know, we hope to see that tide turn. But in the meantime, the little guys have to persevere. They have to take those cases against the giant international law firms that are being used to work for Planned Parenthood and against the courts that are suffering from this terrible abortion distortion. You know, we hope they get over it soon. But we, as people, need to keep voting. I love that there's legislation being written to include important things in what the duties of these organizations are. I apologize, Mr. McCaig, that I did not ask you more questions. But to make it up to Mr. McCaig, we're going to have a meeting outside in the terrarium about the National Lawyers Association right at the close of this meeting. We're going to have free NLA bags to give to you, along with your Advocati bag, if yours from last year broke. And he's going to talk to us about the exciting possibility of starting an Ohio chapter. So, John Farnan, past president of the NLA. John, I'm kidding. Mr. McCaig, the current president, are going to be speaking with us about that. So before I close, if you need the activity number, I will give you that. But if you have completed your course evaluation and put your Supreme Court number on that and you're an Ohio lawyer, you will get credits. I want to thank our vice president, Matt Waters. He has been behind the scenes helping us put this whole thing together. So thank you, Matt. And our other behind-the-scenes lawyer who refuses to be on the board but acts as our secretary anyway, Mrs. Phyllis Crespo. Thank you, Phyllis. Okay, let me get you the activity number. If you have not received a course evaluation, please see Matt. And the winner is... I'm kidding. The activity code for this activity is 0003529780003529780. 0003529780. And remember, of the 3 hours, one will count toward professional conduct, substance abuse, etc. Thank you to my gentlemen on the panel, Mr. McCaig, Mr. Hurley, and Mr. Terrio. Thank you for the good work, capital G, good work you're doing to help fight the pro-abortion, pro-homosexual marriage, and anti-family culture.
You have been listening to Marilyn Crisafi, president and founder of Advocati. The title of her presentation was What Do You Need to Know About Life? You are invited to listen to our radio program From the Median, heard nightly for continuing education and inspiration in this, the greatest civil rights struggle of our times, the right to life. Please visit our website at fromthemedian.org for details.